This is Pardes from Jerusalem, the weekly Parsha podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org. In this week's episode, Rabbi Rachel Berkowitz discusses Sukkot.
The holiday of Sukkot is soon upon us. Torah teaches us that the main mitzvah of the day is to sit in the sukkah. In Sefer Vayikra, Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23, the text tells us, "Besukot tishu shiva yamim," that we should sit in the sukkah for 7 days. Pasuk 43, Mem Gimel, explains to us why. "Leman yedu dartechem," so that we should know for generations to come of the Jewish people. "Ki besukot hoshavti et bnei Yisrael behotzeiti otam mi'eretz Mitzrayim," that I, the Divine, place the children of Israel in Sukkot, so that they, at the time when they were being brought out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, so that they should know this fact. Why exactly it's important to know this fact, the Pasuk doesn't exactly tell us. The Midrash Halacha, the Sifra, on this verse says specifically that the link to Behotzeiti Atem Me'eretz Mitzrayim melamed sh'af ha-sukkah zecher l'tziat Mitzrayim, that also the mitzvah of sukkah, besides the whole experience that we have on Pesach, that we do many things to remember our experience of going out of Mitzrayim, the sukkah itself is supposed to remind us of that experience, the experience when we went from being human slaves to a human master, to being a free, unified people, serving the divine. The question is, how does sitting in a sukkah exactly remind us of this and teach us this? The Rashbam on this verse gives an explanation that I think is one of the major traditionally accepted explanations. He says the following: we specifically celebrate the holiday of Sukkot at the time of the harvest festival, at the harvest, right? Actually, in the cycle of the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, it would make sense to celebrate Sukkot after Pesach, before Shavuot, or maybe just after Shavuot when we're traveling in the desert. But why is it here linked to the Chagei Tishrei? It's because this is the time in the year when, as an agricultural people, we had a harvest. At the time of the harvest, our houses are full. Beitecha mele'im kol tov. Our houses are full with all the good, all the food, all the corn, all the wine, all the oil that we've collected. And we sit in the sukkah at this time of the year. Laman, this is the Rashbam I'm quoting, "Laman tisgeru ki besukot hoshavti et bnei Yisrael, babibar abim shana, belo yeshuv, belo nachala, mikochtach natnu hoda'a lemi shenotein lahem nachala ubeitechem mele'im kol tuv." We remember that for 40 years, we didn't have civilization. We didn't have a physical inheritance. We didn't have settlement. We didn't have a home. And therefore, nowadays, when we're giving our harvest, we give thanks to the one that has given us a place, a land, a home that are filled with all these good things. And most importantly, it says, "Al tamru b'levavchem, k'chai v'atzum yadai, asali et hachayel hazeh." One of the main messages of Sukkot is that we should not say in our hearts that it was our own hands that did all this greatness for ourselves. We should not get overcome by the hard work we did in planting the field and watering it and harvesting it, and forget that really, actually, all this natural goodness was provided to us by the divine. And so by going out of our houses that are filled with the collection of the harvest and sitting in Sukkot, we remember the experience when we were in the Midbar and we had no one to take care of us but the divine. And so it seems from this understanding that part of the experience of the mitzvah of Sukkot is to deal with human hubris, to make us realize, yes, you worked hard, yes, your hands can produce incredible things, but don't get over your station. Don't think that you are the only one to thank. Remember that really there is something greater than yourself. I would like to take this idea of what the essence of the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah is, and suggest that the rabbis in the time period of the Mishnah use this opportunity to make a social critique of something that existed in their day, and that is slavery. How, you ask, did they do such a thing? I would like to suggest that by looking at the Mishnah, Masechet Sukkah, chapter 2, we can see this social critique. I believe, and I think this is one of the unique ways we learn Mishnah here at Pardes, is that the Mishnah is not just a law book which tells you practical things of how to behave. If that was the case, it's written in a most confusing fashion, because half the time no one knows exactly what to do. But rather, it is also a vehicle to tell us the theology and philosophy of the rabbis, and that by looking at the structure and the language of how they present the laws, you can get to a deeper meaning and understanding of their thoughts. So what's fascinating about the second chapter of Mishnah Sukkah is that the first Mishnah of the chapter, and in a moment I'll read it to you, speaks about slaves, and the last two Mishnayot of the chapter speak about slaves. So when you have a nice envelope structure like this, where a theme appears in the first Mishnah and in the last Mishnah, it gives you a hint that this is something of importance that the rabbis want to talk about. So let's try to unpack these Mishnayot and see what could possibly their message be. The first Mishnah opens with a simple halacha. Hayoshein tachat hamita besukah lo yatza yedei chavato. If someone sleeps under a bed inside the sukkah, they have not fulfilled their obligation. Now, this is just sounds like a very practical and straightforward halakha. You have a sukkah, and then you have a bed inside, and the bed has a frame and presumably some type of mattress, right? If you can sleep under it, it's not a mat on the floor. And the idea is that if you're underneath the bed, you're not really underneath the sukkah. You're supposed to be inside the sukkah with the schach above you. And if you're in a structure that also has sides and a top, and you're underneath that, it's the top of the bed that's really above you and not the schach. And so being under the bed somehow negates being in the sukkah, and you have not fulfilled your experience of sukkah. Seems straightforward. We're going to come back to this idea in a second. What's fascinating is the Mishnah, if it only wanted to convey this information to us of what the law is, it should stop there, but it continues. And it tells a very interesting story. Rabbi Huda tells us that he said when he was young, they used to sleep under the sukkah all the time. And in fact, they did so in front of the elders. V'lo amru lo anu davar. The elders never said anything to us that we were doing something wrong or that it was, you weren't fulfilling your obligation. That's the first thing he says. And then Rabbi Shimon says, you know what? I'll tell you the story. Maseh betavi avdo shel Rabbi Gamliel, shehaya yoshein tachat hamita. Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Nasi, who was the head of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael at the time, he was very wealthy, and he had slaves. We know of his slaves because there are a number of stories, and his main sort of right-hand man, butler, was named Tavi. And apparently, Tavi would sleep under the bed in the sukkah. I presume Rabbi Gamliel was sleeping on the bed, and Tavi was sleeping under. Maybe he needed a glass of water in the night. Maybe he wanted to be right there to serve him, right near him. He didn't want to leave him and be in the house. But what is interesting about this act is Rabbi Gamliel is very excited. Rabbi Gamliel says, Amar lehem, Rabbi Gamliel is a kenim. He tells the elders, Ra'item Tavi avdi shehu talmid chacham. Did you see Tavi, my slave? He's a talmid chacham. He is a student of the chachamim, of the sages. And why is that? V'yodea sha'avadim turim min ha'sukah, l'fichach yoshein hu tachat hamita. He's a student of the sages. He knows, I think v'yodea is an interesting word here, because the experience of, that we were told in the pasuk was that we need to know something as well, right? L'man yedu. What does he know? He knows slaves are exempt from the sukkah, and therefore he sleeps under the bed. There's a lot we could talk about here. I won't get into the question of if being exempt means that you shouldn't do something. He seems to understand that he shouldn't do it. And we don't explain yet why slaves are exempt from the sukkah. We're going to find that out in a later Mishnah. But he knows this fact. He's a Talmid Chacham. He wants to do what the Chachamim say. And so he does this behavior. And then the Mishnah continues and says, L'fi darkenu, l'madnu shehayashen tachan amita lo yatza yedei chavato. And then it seems, from this story, we learn something in general, that the one who sleeps on the sukkah doesn't fulfill his obligation. Right? Tavi knew he wasn't obligated, so he slept under the mitah, which means that Tavi thinks that under the mitah, you don't fulfill your obligation. And so from this story, we learn the halacha from Tavi that sleeping under the sukkah, under the mitah, under the bed in the sukkah, you don't fulfill your obligation. So the statement that was said as fact in the first sentences of the Mishnah, under the bed in a sukkah, you don't fulfill your obligation of sukkah, was learned through the actions of the slave, through Rabbi Gamliel telling about it, and then we learned a general rule for all people. That's Mishnah number one. So let's hold that in our hands and look at the end of the chapter. At the end of the chapter, there are two Mishnayot that mention slaves. One is Mishnah 8, where it says outright the halakha that it seemingly Tavi already knew. Nashim v'avadim u'ktanim p'turim min ha-sukkah. Women, slaves, and minors are exempt from the sukkah. So this text doesn't tell us why, but it does link together a unit of people, three groups of people, that the rabbis like to link together in a number of places throughout the Mishnah. Why do the rabbis link women, slaves, and minors together? The understanding is that there's some unifying factor between these three groups of people. And apparently the unifying factor is, this is based on other texts, that all three of these groups of people are in the domain of others. Women are either in the domain of their husbands or their fathers. Slaves are in the domain of their masters. And children are in the domain of their fathers, of their parents. And so they are not free functioning agents in the sense that they are responsible for others. In fact, others are responsible for them. They are bereshut acherim. Others have responsibility to give them shelter, to give them food, to give them clothes, etc. And if we understand how to read Mishnah carefully, it seems to be that something about this fact of being in this social status in society exempts you from the sukkah. What do I mean by this? I'll give you an example of another Mishnah that uses the same formulation. There's a Mishnah in Masechet Brachot, the third chapter, the third Mishnah, that says women, slaves, and minors are exempt from reading the Shema. And the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, explains why is it that slaves are exempt from reading the Shema. And it says, Shenemar, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Ad She'ein Lo Adon Ela HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yatza Eved She'yesh Lo Adon Acher. The whole purpose of saying the Shema is to accept the oneness and uniqueness of God and God alone as the be-all and end-all. But that's not true for a slave. A slave has a human master. And so it would be a farce in some way for the slave to say Shema. So the slave is exempt from saying Shema because Yesh Lo Adon Acher, he has another master. And the question is if we can understand this line of the exemption from Sukkah in some type of similar way. First of all, if these people are not masters of their domain, and the Sukkah, we're going to learn in the next Mishnah, is really moving the home, which is the domain, right, that they live in, to a temporary structure. Clearly, these are groups of people that in this social structure have no control over where the homestead is placed. Obviously, they are not the ones to define this domain. If also part of the lesson that we're trying to learn about from Sukkah is that the plethora of the harvest and the capability that we have of human hubris to overcome us and forget where it all came from, it might be that these people who do not own harvest, who do not own fields, who do not own property, are less susceptible to this fear and are exempt from the sukkah. The Mishnah goes on after this line and wants to talk a little bit about minors. It says, a minor that doesn't need its mother anymore, can survive without its mother's milk, is obligated in the sukkah. I read you this part because there's a story here as well that's interesting. It's a story about Shammai, the elder Shammai's daughter-in-law. Apparently, she gave birth very close to the time of Sukkot, and she had a baby that was still sleeping with her. Maybe it wasn't close. They nursed for a long time in that time period. And the baby is staying with its mother in the bed. And what did he do? He opened up the ceiling, presumably of their house, and he put schach al gabi hamita bishvil hakatan. So I tell you this because it's interesting, this story, to juxtapose it with our last story. Last story, we had a sukkah that had a bed in it. So in this story, we also have a sukkah. Rather, we have a house that has a bed in it, and we take the house and we turn the house into a sukkah above the bed. And now, instead of having the slave that sleeps under the bed, we have the baby that's sleeping on the bed, because there's an understanding that people who are obligated in in sukkah should have their home within the sukkah, and they should sleep on a bed under schach. So just this story already links us to thinking about the last story. Now let's come to the last Mishnah of the chapter. This is a very famous Mishnah. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. And it's only in the last Mishnah of the chapter that they actually tell us the main halakha, which is typical of the Mishnah. It says, Kol shivat hayamim adam oseh sukkato keva ubeito arai. All 7 days of the holiday of Sukkot, a person should make his sukkah the main permanent abode, and his house should become a temporary abode. The domain in which he lives should switch, and we should have this feeling of temporariness, right? And that's what we talked about, that the meaning was we should realize that everything is temporary, that everything is in sense out of our control, and that we are not the masters of our domain. And so when we move to a new temporary domain, we feel that lack of permanence, that vulnerability that we don't have when we're in our own home. And the Mishnah doesn't stop there. It tells a story. Oh, it first tells us a halacha. I jumped ahead. It says, if it rains on Sukkot, from when are you allowed to leave the sukkah? Which is an interesting idea that you would assume you can rain. And it's also an interesting idea. I thought the whole idea was to show that the sukkah protects us from God, but God can also make weather and not protect us well by bringing rain. And to answer this question, it says from the time that the food starts to go rotten, that the parge of the dish starts to spoil. If it's so much rain that it's ruining your food, you know that you don't have to sit in the sukkah. And then the text tells us a mashal. It tells us a parable. Mashlu mashal lama adavar domeh. What is this comparable to? Le'eved sheba limzo kos l'rabo v'shafach lo kiton al panav. It is comparable to a slave who brings his master the jug of drink, of water, and instead of the master being so happy that the slave has brought him the service that he needed, he takes the jug and he pours it on the slave's face. He slaps it in the face, right? Total outright rejection of the slave's service. This apparently is in how we're supposed to understand the experience of rain in the sukkah. So we, in this mashal, are the slave. Obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the divine, is the master to some extent, and is the Rabbo. And we are come to do God's want by sitting in the sukkah, to serve and do Avodah Hashem. And by raining on us, it is as if the master is saying, I don't want your service, get away from me. And that then we know that we're allowed to leave the sukkah. Now this is bizarre, it's crazy. This is how the chapter ends. The chapter ends. We're trying to do mitzvot, and somehow our behavior is making God angry and doesn't want us. And this is an interesting juxtaposition to the master in the first Mishnah, right? There too, Tabi was also trying to do mitzvot, but Rabbi Gamliel was so happy. He's like, look what a Talmid Chacham. Look at this. This is so wonderful, his behavior. There, the master was extremely happy with the slave. And here, God is not happy with our behavior. I would like to suggest that this message that the rabbis are trying to tell us of possibly what type of behavior that God is not happy with is the concept of slavery in general, right? If the message of Sukkot, which is linked to the message of Yitziat Mitzrayim, is that remember you were once slaves and how terrible that was, right? That's Yitziat Mitzrayim, and you don't want to have, we shouldn't be treating people like slaves again. Yet, human society at the time did have slavery, as did people all around them. And the rabbis are not, in my belief, are not superhuman. They cannot just snap their fingers and society change. But they can educate towards a different behavior. And I would like to suggest here that they are educating against the concept of slavery, and they're doing it with the holiday of Sukkot, because that is really the message of Sukkot. Because if you really believe that that the divine in the world is the source of all life and all good things, that human hubris shouldn't get the most of you, then clearly, and we clearly believe that all human beings are created in the image of the divine, then for one person to rule over another is really antithetical to the message of Sukkot. And what I love and I think is so beautiful about this chapter is that this idea that human beings are equal and a desire for equality by human beings is shown to us through our comparison with Tavi. We are the same as Tavi and he is the same as us. What do I mean by this? In the first Mishnah, Tavi was called the Talmid Chacham, which is what I hope that all of us in the Jewish people strive to be. He's like us. He just wants to learn Torah and do what God wants and to do mitzvot, right? And in the last Mishnah, we are the same as him. We are a slave that's trying to serve their master. And we're both striving to do the same thing. And we're both trying to follow mitzvot to the best of our ability. But what's very interesting is what we learned about domains from Tavi, right? And if we understand what he was teaching us about the mitzvah of sleeping under the bed or not sleeping under the bed at Sukkot is very, very interesting. If I had a board, I'd draw this so everyone imagine this in their minds right now, right? Draw just like two walls and a top for a sukkah and then draw a mitah underneath it. And you understand that if you're under the mitah, you're not really under the sukkah. I think we can draw a beautiful parallel structure to that, which is if you're under an adon, if you're under a human ruler, then you're also not really under the divine. And the goal of the Jewish people and the experience of sitting in Sukkot is to realize that all of us are really in the domain of the divine. And sitting in the sukkah reminds us that we're in this temporary structure that is the domain of the divine. This is the house that the God provided for us in the Midbar when coming out of Egypt. And that is a house in which there are no other rulers. Humans should not rule other human beings. And I think that this connects very beautifully to a message that we just experienced in Rosh Hashanah with the blast of the shofar. If we were to look at the Mishnayot in Rosh Hashanah, we would learn that the shofar is the instrument that was blown on the Jubilee year. You can see this in the Psukim in Sefer Vayikra as well. And it's the blast that, it's the shofar in the Jubilee year proclaimed freedom. It proclaimed freedom throughout the land. There are no more slaves. There's no more debts. Property reverts back to its rightful owner. And we use the shofar that proclaims freedom to anoint the divine as sovereign over us. And I think that by treating other human beings as equals and acknowledging that one human being should not rule over another and that there is a spark of the divine amongst us is really the true way to see that there's something greater than us that is the source of all life and abundant good in this world. And so I hope that when you sit in the sukkah and you experience the temporariness and the lack of stability and you're away from human civilization for a moment and realize that there's really something greater out there than us, you will also acknowledge that that fact must make us think about how we think about others and how we treat others. Chag Sameach.
Thank you for listening to Pardes from Jerusalem, the weekly Parsha podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit www.elmad.pardes.org.